All right, and we're live. Welcome back to the Loopcast. Today, I'm joined only by Josh. Again, congratulations to Erica. Hope you're enjoying your time at home. She sends her best to the Loopcast listeners. Josh was spending a little extra time getting ready. I think he saw Mitchell's trivia question here. This is a good shout out for the live show. Josh, when was the last time an incumbent president, an opposition party candidate, clinched the required numbers of delegates on the same day?
That's a great question. I hadn't thought about that one. What was the last time? That would be... It has to be relatively quickly on the other side. I don't know. I'll guess 1996, Bob Dole and Bill Clinton.
All right, Mitch, we're going to need a lookup on that. Your trivia credibility is absolutely destroyed if you got that wrong. But if you would like to join in on the fun, we are live here on YouTube Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern time. Shout out to everyone in the chat right now. And then also shout out to the people listening after. We appreciate you guys so much. Today's going to be a combination of what Josh and Tom find interesting. I think Erica kind of rounds us out in a lot of ways. So this one might get a little crazy. Josh, you threw something in as something you wanted to talk about first. What's going on with you?
Well, breaking news. I mean, the Wall Street Journal just reported this Wednesday morning here that Republicans are starting to wake up when it comes to abortion. The guy who's in charge of trying to lead the effort for Republicans to win seats in the House sent out a memo, and the Wall Street Journal got a chance to look at it. And basically they said, I think this is so important. The memo says that Republicans have a brand problem, not a policy problem. Now, that's interesting. So it's not that being pro-life is bad. It's that they're not good at messaging it. Well, I agree with that. And they said, this is interesting, their reluctance to discuss the issue left it to Democrats to outline where the GOP stood. Amen to that. We've been saying that forever. Many voters view the party's hopeful as opposing abortion under any circumstances when there are actually a variety of positions held by candidates, particularly in swing districts, the memo states. So that's actually true. And so some people who are 100% pro-life might get really mad about that. They're like, well, wait a minute. Why isn't every Republican candidate running for office in every district in the entire country 100% pro-life? Hey, look, we haven't had that for decades, so I don't know why you think we'd have that immediately. The question is, does anyone really think Republican politicians right now are 100% pro-life across the board in every district in the country? Well, no, of course not. So if these Republican candidates don't say anything on the issue, then the Democrats get to portray them as being, you know, however they want to describe it, too extreme, too far out of step with the voters in that area. So this has been a clarion call for us at Catholic Vote for a long time. After the midterm elections in 2022, very disappointing results. Republicans thought, oh, we're going to have a red wave. And nothing materialized. They thought, hey, this is great. You know, gas prices are high. Inflation's bad. We'll just sit back and let voters punish the Democrats and we'll sweep into the House, into the Senate. Well, what happened? Republicans didn't win the Senate, even though they had lots of winnable races. And they barely took the House. In fact, we're going to be down to a two-seat majority. The Republicans are next week when Ken Buck resigns. Ken Buck dropped. Like, you can't get thinner than that. And what happened? Well, Catholic Vote President Brian Birch wrote about this in the aftermath of the 2022 elections. And I feel like today's memo from the Wall Street Journal that they got from the House Republicans, it's like, finally, they've got the Birch memo on this. What Brian said back then was, being blunt, there are too many Republicans who don't understand the fight we're in. They really don't seem to understand what Nancy Pelosi and AOC want to do to our country. And if they do, they don't believe telling the public the truth is good politics. They still think it's 1980. The economy is sputtering, inflation is raging, crime is surging. If they just sit back and wait for Americans to grow frustrated, they'll kick the Democrats out of power and put Republicans in charge. Wrong. We need Republicans to wake up before it's too late. And Brian continued, The answer is that more and more voters are culture voters now. Pocketbook issues up to a point are not necessarily the driving issues, nor is foreign policy or tax cuts or the myriad of other reasons that demand our politics in recent years. Left-wing culture warriors understand the stakes. They defend their issues by painting their picture of the good life that includes support for abortion on demand for any reason at any time. They talk about building a world free of racism, sexism, and oppression, crafty slogans for their plans to destroy the family, indoctrinate kids, and consolidate power. He goes, but why are Republicans and conservatives not sharing their vision of the good life? Don't just talk about gas prices and food. I mean, it is important that we need to stop inflation, but you got to paint a picture of the good life. And when it comes to abortion, when it comes to transgender surgeries on our youth, you can't just wish these issues away. You can't just hope that, let's not talk about it anymore. So,
I completely agree with you. And I think, especially as a younger voter, that's basically only grown up in a time where politics basically was relevant for culture issues. What would you suggest the good life that Republicans paint for? Because we agree the shortcomings are obvious, and we agree that the left does a great job of painting the possibility of what could be. But Republicans still haven't really done that, it seems like. Like, what would you, if you were sitting in that meeting, you had to give them advice, what would you tell them?
Well, I think, first of all, I applaud them for seeing that the way to deal with an issue is not to run away from it, because you allow your opponent to define it for you. You should say, yeah, actually, we want to help young women in need. And that's what this article is pointing to. Come up with common sense solutions that 60-70% of the American public agree with, and say, but, you know, when it comes to abortions in the 7th, 8th, and 9th month, that's just horrible. And in fact, that's what Donald Trump sounded like in 2016 when he was going in that debate against Hillary Clinton. He goes, oh, I don't know, this abortion is the 7th and 8th and 9th month. That's crazy. He spoke in the most pro-life way ever. Like most Republicans, when they run for office, they always opt for the path of least resistance. They'll say a sentence or two on the issue 9 months ahead of time and then never let anything else happen. And they just expect pro-life organizations and pro-life voters to do all the work for them. But if they don't talk about the issue, if they don't show any leadership and say, yeah, actually, we want to build a culture of life. We think having this idea of a disposable society where we just get rid of our problems and get rid of our babies, that's not the answer. You know, it's not empowering women to promote abortion for them in the 7th, 8th, and 9th month. Can't we come up with something better than this? So I think that would be good if Republican politicians could talk like that.
Yeah, I think the life issue for sure, because I think we've maybe just internalized the message of like abortion equals freedom or equal rights or the ability to work or whatever. It's been so effectively done by the left or abortion advocates that that's almost synonymous. But I guess I haven't really thought about like, well, what if one side was trying to basically create a culture in which abortion would be unthinkable? You wouldn't even have to. You'd have the support that you need if you were to have a baby. Maybe you'd have some. The government can help in ways that isn't just, well, let's just give them ways to kill their children. You know what I mean? Or like incentivize through tax, like family planning. Like I think of Hungary, like how good Hungary has been on a lot of the pro-family
stuff.
Well,
true family planning, not what we call today.
Well, family planning now is a euphemism, but I just mean like the ability to basically
pro-family policies.
Pro-family policy is in like the most simplest of the version is one person in your household could make enough money to buy a home, to be able to live off that income with the mom being able to stay home and raise the kids. Like that as an option for all Americans, I think would be a phenomenal pitch.
So what requires is that I agree with you. I think what it requires is conservative candidates to talk about the good life. Say, what can we do to get, you know, young couples who want to start a family, get them into like a starter home that's maybe a little bit smaller. You know, right now there's a lot of cities and areas that are making it harder to build out. They're increasing the zoning regulations on houses and stuff like that. So like if you live in a blue state, it's very hard to get smaller homes. And in fact, Texas, there's not as much of a housing problem because Texas has pro-housing policies. So they allow you know, more affordable, smaller houses to be built. And that gives that couple that chance to get a leg in and to start that family. But in places like, you know, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, they make it very hard. It's not just like, oh, it's expensive there. I mean, look, I'm not just talking about the cities. I'm talking about the general area. Like Portland is not like, you know, New York City in terms of the number of people live there, but they have such restrictive housing things. Republicans need to talk about it. You want to be pro-life, pro-family. Talk about some of these proposals out there that really make it hard to get families up off the ground. It's not just the college debt stuff, which is true. I've been saying that before too. I think the millennials and the Gen Z are onto something. Like college debt is too much, and yeah, we need to rethink this.
Josh,
we need to do all these things,
or maybe just direct the conversation, because I've even just kind of taken a step back. Someone commented in, do you think coming at it from a financial perspective is too negative? And even just how we've talked about it, it's like, well, how can we change tax policy, or how can we change the student debt thing, or how do we replan cities? Like, all that is very like downstream Republican talking point for sure.
Right.
And I think this gets at like the core of the issue. The culture wars, quote unquote, are important because they're fight over what culture should be. I think, right, like if we can establish at its core, I would like to build a culture in America where it's easy and encouraged societally to get married. Right. It's easy and encouraged to have children. It's easy and encouraged to be civically engaged in your church community, in your local government community, to live in a safe neighborhood that is free from crime or other things. And then also to like feel connected in the fabric of that society, the people around you. So I'm thinking of like small businesses in your neighborhood. Like it's easy to start a business. Like all of that in my mind, you wrap that up in a ball. That is the good life. Like when we have
right,
to fight
and we used
over,
to call that the American dream, right?
Right. I think we're just getting back to the American dream, but like we almost need to be more explicit because there's a lot of forces, like how crazy the left has gotten in terms of like, okay, you could be a man, woman, anything in between. Like that goes against that vision of the good life, right? Because there's men and women who are married in that good life scenario. So we have to fight for that. We have to fight about what they're teaching our children. Like that's a stopping point. That's against that American dream. So maybe people just did it better when they call it the American dream, but I think it's almost like we internalize that, me and you do. So we always go to the next step of like, well, how do we plan the cities or how do we do tax breaks? Maybe it's just important to take a step back and be like, no, this is the good life and it's worth protecting. I don't know.
I think you're 100% right that we need to do more of that. We need to sell what it is. Like, look, you know, we have a current situation where so many people feel sort of despondent and there's a kind of general malaise and there's a lot of people that just feel like things aren't adding up right. That's why I think actually Tim Carney's book on Family and Friendly is a good book for everyone to read. We're going to have that interview, I think, going up live next week. And he talks about it. Like, why is it that like the number of white suburban women who are on drugs is like off the charts? They're prescription drugs, but still it's just like, you know, it's like an epidemic. Like what is the problem? Why aren't you living the good life? And it's because we've been sold a lie about what is the thing that's supposed to matter to you? Chase the influencers. It's all a bunch of garbage. Like family, church, and local community, that's where it's at. That's where you're going to find your purpose. That's where you're going to find the American dream. I do think we need to sell that a little bit better. I agree.
And not even just us, like on our level. I think we definitely could. But I think back to the Wall Street Journal, it's like at a political level, a winning message, which I think Trump has tapped into and why he's so relevant, is speaking in those terms instead of just going to the next step of like, well, we're going to get these tax breaks and we're going to organize in this way. It's like Trump was very clear about what he was presenting. He's like, we are going to make America great again. It's like, right. I don't know. There's just few Republicans that talk in those terms. I think we've just gotten used to these really like 2000s bomb foreign countries and cut taxes politicians that are very inauthentic. And I really think like the next generation smartly would go back to the core of like the American dream, basically, like why people love America, because it's clearly the other side. I think I saw a stat like 80 some percent of Democrats view the American flag negatively. And I think like 50% of Republicans do. It's crazy now that that's even like, I thought.
Well, I don't know if that's that high amongst Republicans. I don't even know if it's that high amongst Democrats, but you know, it needs to be better. That's for sure. And
the poll was taken during 2020. So I think there's a lot of the George Floyd racial injustice type stuff going on, but yeah, we need to be better on that. If I could though, I'd like to give a shout out, Dom Higgy coming into the church. I don't know if this is Batman commenting in, that's his little picture here on YouTube, but congratulations. You're coming to the church on Easter, Dave's Vault indeed. Really happy for you.
That's awesome news, bud. We're praying for you.
And Archul, first time watching you guys, faithful Spotify listener. Great to actually catch the live stream today and faces to your voices. Archul, thank you for joining. Thank you for listening. Really appreciate everyone here in the chat. It's a lot of fun live. Oh, Josh, you got to talk about what you want to talk about. I got to talk about Boeing, okay? You're going to have to sit through this.
I mean, it's okay. I mean, I'm flying less nowadays because of this kind of stuff.
Exactly. Okay. So,
I ain't gonna lie to you.
This is going to be a winding journey we're all going to take together. So I just started digging into Boeing a little bit. The reason I did is because I saw a headline about a man, rest in peace, John Barnett. He was a Boeing whistleblower, and he was just unfortunately found dead from a quote-unquote self-inflicted gunshot wound in his car. He was in Charleston for he's a Boeing whistleblower. I think he blew a whistle back in like 2019. He retired in 2017, and he was giving evidence during this investigation into Boeing about them cutting corners on their 737 MAX. This was basically an attempt to beat out their rival Airbus. Not good when you're talking about commercial airplanes that fly people. So he worked in quality in Boeing for over 32 years. I'm not going to get super technical, but he saw many, many problems and what was described as basically the tip of the iceberg of a lot of quality control problems for what Boeing was doing to basically cut corners to get their planes in the air to beat competition. So the real problems for this, though, if we go back to 2019, there were two planes, both 737 MAXs, that crashed. No real explanation for it. They crashed within 5 months of each other. One was in Ethiopia and one was in Indonesia. I think the death toll on it.
Well, I mean, the thing is that, you know, this is where I show my age. Plane crashes were actually kind of common in the 70s, you know? And so like people were still kind of skittish about it, even into the 1980s in terms of flying. It's only been, and that's kind of a faded memory now for thankfully, for so many people, it's very rare now.
Don't love that it's coming back.
No, certainly not.
Unfortunately, in these 2019 crashes, it killed, I think death toll was like 300, over 300 people. People just died on the flights when they crashed. The problem was they were nosediving. So they were nosediving, according to Boeing, because they got dragged in front of Congress. The DOJ did an investigation into them. They were saying that they were blaming the pilots, basically. So they came forward, they blamed the pilots. The investigation yielded that there was something wrong with the software called MCAS. And it'd be very interesting if we have any pilots in the Loopcast audience, which is very possible. Maybe you're listening to this flying. I'd love to hear more on the perspective of someone on the inside. But basically, this MCAS system.
And we will protect you.
Yeah, exactly. It was designed to keep planes from stalling. And so that's all going on. And interestingly enough, there was a really, really sketchy resolution of that in 2021 at the same time of a lot of like the Capitol riot stuff. So they really kind of slid under the radar what the punishment was. And it was essentially like a couple $100 million slap on the wrist. But fast forward to January, the 737 MAX had a door blowout on an Alaska Airlines flight. I don't know if you guys remember seeing this.
Oh, yeah.
Crazy.
It was crazy.
I don't know if you can imagine sitting in that seat and just like air just flying through. So it blows out.
I think one of the kids' shirts ripped off because the
shirt pressure. Ripped off. There's like stuff flying out. It was nuts. And fortunately, no one was harmed.
Right.
No one was harmed, but it kind of re-brought up like, hey, didn't we investigate them in 2019? Why is this happening? So Congress
is usually sort of forget, like, you know, you're that close from something going really, really bad. I mean, the thing is, like, I feel like a lot of times in our society today, people just sort of take things for granted. Like the fact that we can travel through the air at 25, 30,000 feet. It's amazing technology, but man, if things don't go right.
Right. Which I think we'll get to the point, but like the point is these aren't like washer or dryers. Like there needs to be an extra level of quality assurance and due diligence to the point where there could basically be no screw ups. You'll kind of see as we go through this, like, unfortunately, there's kind of a ugly part of Boeing rearing its head where they've really cut a lot of corners where they shouldn't have been. So on Friday, Boeing informed a congressional panel that it was unable to find a potentially important record detailing its work on the panel that later blew out. So they just said, well, we can't find it. The company had been asked to produce any documentation it had related to the removal and reinstallation of the panel. and a letter to Senator Maria Cantwell, who chairs the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee. Boeing said it had conducted an extensive search, but could not find the record of the information being sought by the Senate panel and by the safety board.
Cantwell, she's, of course, horrible pro-abortion, so-called Catholic, but she's from the state of Washington, which Boeing was headquartered in Seattle, yeah. Generations. Now they're based out of, I think, Chicago or something like that.
Are they in Charlotte now?
Oh, yeah. They moved from Chicago to somewhere else. Yeah, maybe it's Charlotte. So, I mean, anyway, I'm sure they've given her tons of money back in the day, but.
Oh,
maybe
no
she's
doubt.
Upset she's not getting the money anymore. I don't know.
Okay, so I wish I could just end it here, but Josh, it keeps going. So the Federal Aviation Administration did a six-week audit, okay, to Boeing's production of the 737 MAX. This is the plane that's been having all the problems. So this is where I want to tag like some of the pilots. Hopefully we got some positive aviation people in the audience. So it said, for the portion of the examination focused on Boeing, the FAA conducted 89 product audits, a type of review that looks at aspects of the production process. The plane maker passed 56 of the audits and failed 33 of them, with a total of 97 instances of alleged noncompliance, according to the presentation. FAA also conducted 13 product audits for the part of the inquiry that focused on Spirit AeroSystems, which makes the fuselage or body of the 737 MAX. Six of these audits resulted in passing grades. Seven resulted in failing ones, the presentation said. Oh boy. Not good. And then it gets back to the guy Barnett, who supposedly committed suicide in his car, which I'm going to say highly doubt on that one. He was in Charlotte for these legal interviews related to the case against Boeing. Basically when he didn't show up, they found him in a parking lot. I was looking a little bit deeper into some of his, like what he was digging into. And I found this video, undercover video being in the factory of Boeing. Okay. And this guy was going around in this factory in Charlotte and asking people, would you fly in this plane that you're creating? 10 out of the 15 employees working there said they would not fly in Boeing's new 787 Dreamliner because they saw how bad the quality was. An anonymous employee described it as an iceberg. He said that there's drug testing there, so legitimately people would be like high on the job. That gets back to my problem with a lot of unions. Crazy video. Yeah, Charleston, South Carolina. There we go.
Assembling the company's flagship product, the 787 Dreamliner. But this footage reveals some have little faith in the plane they build.
Did you fly on one?
No.
You won't fly on one. Did you fly on one of these planes?
No. 15 wow.
Asked randomly, 10 said they would not fly on the Dreamliner.
I wouldn't fly on one of these planes because I see the quality of it.
An employee captured the footage after contacting Al Jazeera to tell us he had serious concerns about what he was seeing. At his request, we changed his voice.
With all the problems reported on the 787, there's 90% that's getting swept away, hushed up. It's an iceberg.
In another meeting, the source told us workers are often underskilled, uncaring, and in some cases on drugs.
I've seen a lot of things that should not go on at an airplane plant. People talking about doing drugs, looking for drugs.
It's all coke and painkillers. And people say that you can get weed here. It's a really good weed here.
Oh, that's great. So it's a Hollywood party.
They don't drug test. That is insane.
You know, you say the unions. I've been a member of a union before, and you know, they require a drug test. They required a drug test. The food handlers, United.
You're a union guy.
Not for super long, maybe a year or so when I was a teenager, but you know.
Yeah, I've probably said people might know I come from a family of teachers, so I'm very familiar with the infamous teachers union and the power that they wield. But I'm also from the Detroit area, so there's a lot of UAW people too.
The unions did a really good job of creating an anti-union guy for life, because they're like, you have to pay union dues, but since you only work part-time, you get zero benefits. I'm like, oh, super.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Super. I'll remember that. Thanks. So you know, you're 17 years old and you look at, who is FICA and why are they taking so much of my money? Oh, that's Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. Okay, great. Okay.
Exactly.
Oh, what's this union do? Oh, okay, great. How much is left for me?
Oh, yeah. Josh, we got to talk about Medicare and Medicaid. But before I finish, the most recent problem is that there is another Boeing plane on its way from Auckland to Sydney, and it just dropped out of the sky. Again, I think I saw injury estimates up to 50 people, but it recorrected at the last second. The pilot just said that things went blank. Do I have to say this? Like, I think that this is a much different situation than widgets or washing machines. Like, and
yeah, obviously automobiles and airplanes should have the most strict scrutiny, and, you know, like
100%
have regulators making sure that these things are safe. Like, come on, take care of this. Who's the secretary of the Department of Transportation? Oh, right. Mr. Bear. Yeah.
And he's had a bad record on, like, didn't they have, I think, like, all the flight transportation stuff just shut down, like the scheduling back and forth, so people weren't able to go. But it makes me nervous. I think, like, another problem with this too is you've seen all, like, the Spirit, like the LGBTQ stuff everywhere, the DEI stuff everywhere. And whether or not that's involved, I think that definitely gets some scrutiny when planes are falling out of the air. Like, you can't have any other focus as a company if planes are falling out of the air other than making good parts, or you should just be disbanded, right? So, like, when you have all these other kind of funsy, like, wow, look at all the queer people we hired, like, who cares? Like, it's kind of a, I don't know if it's like,
you wonder how we're going to get to, like that, but yeah, you watch the movie Idiocracy and you're like, oh, okay, maybe we are heading this way.
Like, yeah.
Things just stop working, right? Makes you want to drive everywhere. I mean, we're Midwest guys anyway. We like to drive.
Hopefully this doesn't get down to cars, but man, yeah, the Boeing needs to get their act together. They've really, I guess, really throttled their production on the 737 and then the 787. And that Airbus is their big rival, has been selling more. But if Airbus doesn't have the side of their plane falling off, then I'm game for Airbus. We went down this journey together. But Josh, you mentioned Medicare, Medicaid, and this is probably our, like, trending thing I saw, probably for the wrong reasons, over the weekend. I'm not sure. I don't know if you threw the link in there, but basically Ben Shapiro.
That's why I was a few minutes late. You're like, a few minutes late, mate.
Dude, I was mad.
It's a live show, people. Folks. And we love you. We love our audience. That's why, hey, breaking news, lots of information coming in. We want to make sure we got the most up-to-date info.
In fairness, that was breaking that happened yesterday, but
no, the other thing was breaking. And frankly, everything in my tech thing was breaking. That was what was going on, man.
Josh, the punishment for showing up late to the live show might be caning. So I hope you're prepared.
I can hack it.
Basically, Ben Shapiro was talking about Medicare, Medicaid, and he was attacking the concept of Medicare, Medicaid, retirement in general, and that the retirement age is 65, because I believe President Biden has talked about moving it back.
It all started because Trump floated this idea of making cuts to entitlements, which I thought was really stupid of him. And so Biden was like, great. He just gave me an issue to run on because, you know, there's a lot of old voters. The very oldest voters were supportive of Biden. And so, like, just give him, Biden's like, you're just giving me a reason to run to get reelected by talking about cuts to Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. So foolish.
So I don't know if we want to play the clip, then we can probably.
Well, before he gets to Ben, let me, you know, like, this is what Trump said. There's a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting, and in terms of also the theft and the bad management of entitlements, tremendous bad management of entitlements. And so then Biden jumped right all over. He goes, I won't cut Social Security and I won't cut Medicare. Biden said, I will protect and strengthen Social Security, Medicare, and make the wealthy begin to pay their fair share. Which I think he would just raise the amount of payroll taxes that the wealthy have to pay. So Ben Shapiro's thought on this one is like, hey, this is an opportunity to tell everyone why I'm right, because that's what matters to some pundits more than anything else, to show how correct they are. And Ben Shapiro goes on to talk about how, like, entitlements are cost a ton of money, which is true. But then he says this. We got the clip now?
Yep.
And let's be real about this. It's insane that we haven't raised the retirement age in the United States. It's totally crazy. Joe Biden, if that were the case, Joe Biden should not be running for president. Hey, Joe Biden is 81 years old. The retirement age in the United States at which you start to receive Social Security and you are eligible for Medicare is 65. Joe Biden has technically been eligible for Social Security and Medicare for 16 years, and he wants to continue in office until he is 86, which is 19 years past when he would be eligible for retirement. No one in the United States should be retiring at 65 years old. Frankly, I think retirement itself is a stupid idea unless you have some sort of health problem. Everybody that I know who is elderly, who has retired, is dead within 5 years. And if you talk to people who are elderly and they lose their purpose in life by losing their job and they stop working, things go to hell in a handbasket real quick. But
he's got some points here, but man, like, this is like rat poison kind of political advice. I mean, like, my goodness. And first of all, like, look, Ben Shapiro and I have this in common. We write a lot and we talk in front of a camera a lot, which is actually, by the way, a lot of fun, but it's not like I'm a coal miner. Right. If you're a coal miner or you're working, you know, as a lineman putting up, electrical poles, and you're doing all these hard manual labor kind of stuff, building houses, all that kind of stuff, you're going to be doing that when you're 72, 73, 74, 75 years old. Like, give me a break. So I feel like, you know, in the conservative movement, we've had an appreciation over the last 5-6 years. We're kind of rediscovering this appreciation for Mike Rowe and these dirty jobs and the tough things. And hey, we talk about the differences between men and women. It's men, for the most part, who are putting up these electrical wires, who are, you know, taking care of the sewers, that are building houses, that are in coal mines. Not that there aren't any women in any of these things, but, you know, how many men die every year from these, you know, difficult jobs, these backbreaking jobs, working on an oil rig? You're going to work on an oil rig when you're 74 years old, Ben? I mean, what is he talking about? Like, this stuff is crazy. Now, he does have a point,
okay,
which is not untrue. So actually, one of my favorites, Richard Nixon, he made the point that a lot of businessmen, they yearn to retire so that they can go to West Palm Beach and golf forever and just go to parties and golf and do, you know, have fun for the rest of their lives. And he says, that just sounds like boring as all get out. Like, have some purpose to your life. So I've seen it. I've seen people who, when they retire, they just kind of, all they do is golf or whatever, and that's kind of dumb. But the real people who, when they retire, they find purpose. So I know somebody who was a school teacher her whole life. Now, what is she doing? She's volunteering at the food pantry. She's volunteering for the high school. She's volunteering for the local Catholic charity. She's finding that purpose in life. But that doesn't mean we should expect people who are 75, 76, 77 years old to continue working. So, gosh, Ben. Now, Matt Walsh makes the point online, when it comes to Social Security, it's a Ponzi scheme. It's a scam. And it's not, okay, look, you're not wrong. But the point is, when it comes to saying something like this, being 100% right isn't the only thing. It's not the only point. Hey, everybody, I'm right and you are all wrong. Prudence actually requires that you should spend some time and energy to try to actually, I don't know, maybe persuade people. Hey, by the way, you know, I might be 100% pro-life. You might not be 100% pro-life. I might understand Social Security isn't really the best system ever. Kind of help people and educate them, because the American people have been falsely educated on Social Security their entire lives. They've been paying into this and they say, well, they've been told the lie. Hey, I pay into this and then I'll get my money back. I mean, that's just not true. The money that goes into Social Security isn't put into some like bank. It isn't invested. That money is immediately spent on any number of other things. And then Ukraine. 4 years from now, when you retire, you're getting the wages of a 24-year-old. That's how that happens. Yeah. And it's fine for Matt Walsh to say that. I actually think it's kind of good to educate it. But just understand something, that for the most part, you're talking about people who have been paying into this system for 30, 40, 50 years of their life. Every 2 weeks, they're paying into this. And then if you want to try to change systems, people are going to be like, no, wait a minute. You know, that's the biggest reason why, by the way, like when he was running for president, Herman Cain, He's like, we should get rid of the income tax and switch to a sales tax. Like, that is electoral rat poison. Like, what are you talking about? So everyone who paid into Social Security for 50 years and had their income taxed as well on top of that, on top of the payroll taxes, now they're on a fixed income and they're getting money from Social Security. Now you're going to tax them at 15% sales tax. Like, that would be an egregious injustice. You would be there's no way you would ever get that passed. It's like the dumbest idea.
You know what makes me mad? You know what makes me mad? And you know this. You live in Michigan. You know how, like, every 8 years, some Michigan politician's like, you know what we should do? Let's increase the sales tax by a penny. And then all that money is going to go to fix the roads. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. I mean, my current governor, right?
How many times have they done that now?
She was elected in 2018 to fix the darn roads, except she didn't say darn. And then she got reelected and the roads are still crap.
Right. Well, but the thing is,
it's a joke.
So yes, Gretchen Whitmer has not accomplished that. And in fairness, no governor in Michigan has. But what they do every time is they're like, we're just going to increase the sales tax by a penny and then you can vote on it. It's like a referendum. They're like, that money will go towards the roads. And they never do. And we just have a higher sales tax. So I think it's happened like 3 or 4 times now. I think the sales tax in Michigan is at like 3 cents or 4 cents. Now it's at like 7, I think. And all they've done this every time.
Yes. Right. Right. And you bring up a good point. Like, this is the thing. Trump actually was smarter about this in 2016 and 2020. And I hope this idea of floating cuts to Social Security, he's like realizing that's dumb. And he backtracks and he says, no, 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 no. The answer is, it has to be a bipartisan blue ribbon commission that comes up with a plan. Like, let's create incentives so that people who want to continue working can, you know, delay receiving Social Security benefits, whatever it takes to keep the system moving, you know, or raise the retirement age, you know, down the road or something. But look, what has been the story of politics for the last 25 years or so? It's been disaster. Like Hurricane Katrina, that was a total disaster, right? The debacle in Iraq, you know, that was a complete disaster. Joe Biden withdrawing from Afghanistan, talk about a major catastrophe. 13 Marines die. So many things that have just been a complete, utter failure in leadership. So when it comes to something like Social Security and Medicare, which are statutory, like they're set in stone, sort of, anyone wants to tinker with it, you know, Americans are understandably like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. We've dealt with Iraq, Afghanistan, Katrina, fentanyl crisis, the border wide open. Why don't you fix some of these other things first before we trust you to fix the entitlements? So you can talk to your blue in the face about how this, you know, the money's going to run out in 15, 20 years, which I get it. It's actually true. But until you can show some competency, like, you know, we have regulatory agencies like the FAA that allowed this Boeing plane to take off. Like,
right, exactly.
The government needs to convince the American people that they're getting the job done before they can try to screw something else up.
We need some small wins.
Yes.
Give me competency
in government. That's actually what Biden was talking about when he ran for president. Do you have the adults in charge?
I need to challenge you here. Give me one positive thing. Federal government's done. This is another trivia challenge for you.
Well, I mean, I'm just happy that the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. That's a major win.
Okay. That doesn't count, dude. That's like the biggest thing ever.
Yeah, I mean, look, that is a big thing, though. But that's, you know.
I said a small one. That's all you can.
I gave you. You asked for a small one. I gave you a big one.
You under promise, over deliver. I like that style. So we were talking about family a little bit earlier. I think this one's going to be fun to kind of pull up. So this one is a Italian guy on TikTok. Took to the TikToks to talk about someone was accusing him of having privilege because he has two parents. And I just love this guy's response. I think there's a ton to think on here. Big Red, if you want to share that one.
One thing I will never understand here, how people keep on telling me how I'm privileged and here and there and this and that. Oh, because I have family. Guys, let me explain to you how Italian culture works, which is one thing that I don't know why in America they don't teach you. And this is probably why you have one of the highest depression rates and solitude rates in the world. Guys, in Italy, we have something that we call societal welfare, social welfare, aka every single person has a network of people that helps each other out on different levels. You have psychological problems, you always have somebody to talk to. Family helps each other. Family raises you, but then you take care of them. So a perfect example I can give to you, in Italy, we take care of the elders all the way to the end. We take care of them in our houses. You guys push them in a retirement home. That is the saddest thing in the world. You call it privilege because your society taught you about individualism. Probably because your society wants to control you. Because there's one way you control people is to keep them isolated. One by one, alone, let them see some kind of information, let me dogmatize them and let me control them. What you call privilege in Italy is normality. If your society is messed up, it's not my fault. Before criticizing on the foundation of Italian society, which is the societal caution, look at your own, where you incentivize single families. There are literally tax incentives for single parents, as if society wants you to separate. Guys, the only way for you to come out and to break a vicious cycle is to create a community around you that you can lift up with you. Ever wonder why some of the richest cultures in the world act exactly this way? You know exactly what I'm talking about. But in some cultures, when one person makes money, another 20 made money with him or with her. These kinds of cultures have been running for centuries, even millennia. But somehow, some marketing genius convinced you that everything you do here has to be alone. Which on one side is beautiful. Individualism and personal growth and everything is a beautiful thing. But also knowing that you can rely on a substrate of people that create this cushion for an entire community is a beautiful thing. Combine the two and you can create something magnificent. And this is not privilege. This is common sense, guys. Read some history.
I love it.
Understand. Look at people. Look at society. Look at the problems. Look at better societies. Look at the general happiness in other cultures. Look at why they're happier and then understand. But before commenting on a single person as privileged because of something that is embedded in his culture, because what I just described is embedded in Italian culture as well as Spanish and many other Mediterranean cultures. So look within and figure out your own society. Ciao.
I love it. I love everything.
Never go against the family.
I mean, people accuse me of being Italian because I use my hands so much, but I'm not. But I appreciate what he said.
Yeah, I'm like half. My wife's a little Italian. I just saw that video, made me think of a lot of things. It's ironic. The airplane in the background made me think of the 737, unfortunately. And then when he was talking about look at other societies and compare, this has kind of come out recently, but do you remember Trump called, he used colorful language, but he called Haiti a crap hole country, is somewhat of a paraphrase. Yeah. And
remember all the celebrities,
everyone, Conan O'Brien made a shirt, Haiti's beautiful. Everyone was like, Haiti's the best place ever. It has so much potential. And it's now literally being overrun by a guy named Barbecue, who's a cannibal and kills everyone. I think it's funny, like part of his analysis, you have to acknowledge that some cultures are better than others. And right. It's like that is an unspoken. You can't do that for some reason in America recently.
Well,
like,
and what's interesting about that, Haiti too, is that people come to the defense of Haiti simply because like, oh, Trump must have been attacking it because he hates blacks and Haiti's black and therefore it must be good. It's like, no, stop it, guys.
No, they just want to be contrarian. And even if you want to get into the Haiti stuff, what the Clinton Foundation has done there and completely failed them in promising them a port and then just spending all of the money, I think it was like $2.3 billion on American companies, American contractors in Haiti. I have nothing against the Haitian people. I'm just saying if you have to compare culture. So if he just did an analysis of Italian and American culture. And he nailed it. One of the saddest marks of American culture is when I see people's grandparents like rotting away in nursing homes, rife with opportunity for abuse, of course, but then also like it's just sad and lonely. I don't know. And I think of some other cultures too, like in Japan right now, their elders are dying alone because they didn't have enough kids to replace them or their kids just are no longer connected. I think like it is a really beautiful thing to see at least the respect of your parents raised you so that you are then able to help them as they get older. It's like family helping each other. And I know there's certain situations, I don't want to speak judgmentally on people that have to get people special care in a nursing home, whatever, but it's just become all too common, I think, as like, oh yeah, they're just going to run off to the nursing home. There's no way I'd take them in. It's definitely, I think it goes against human dignity for sure.
It actually relates to Social Security. It's, you know, like the left pushed Social Security on the United States in the 30s, because there were people who were living in poverty and they didn't have any children, and our heart goes out to them. And so what it used to be is that you would have children. One of the reasons you would have children is that there would be somebody to take care of you at the end of your life. So what we decided to do was to socialize the costs and the benefits so that everyone would be able to live at least above poverty level when they're in their elder years. I understand that. But the one of the problems with that is that you get in as much as you pay it in, but there's no incentive to have children. So childless people get taken care of now. Okay, that's great. But then again, like, you know, like I said, Tim Curry wrote the book. He and I each have 6 children. And yet someone who had no children gets the same benefits as we do. That doesn't make any sense. So it used to be there wasn't nursing homes. When you were old, you know, the children would decide how to take care of mom and dad. And now it's just sort of culturally understood. It's like, well, you know, we're not supposed to take care of you. You know, we'll send you to a nursing home and, you know, your nest egg will take care of that until it can't anymore. Then you go on Medicare. It is kind of an unfortunate way of looking at it. Like, that's the thing of people. I tell my kids when they misbehave. Yeah, of course, you know, the Ten Commandments, honor your mother and father and, you know, do what I say. Right. But if we're really being honest, honor thy mother and father, what that comes from is that the Jewish people understood that to mean honor your elders. Because in ancient cultures, if you couldn't, you know, you couldn't work, you couldn't eat. And, you know, the nomads, you were going from here to there to try to find something. And if you couldn't hack it anymore, they just left you like, goodbye. And the Jewish people are like, wait a minute now. This is, we need to honor our father. He had been with us for decades and helped us so much. And if he can't do anything, we need to take care of him. We need to feed him. We sort of lost that, you know, insight. And like where we farm, like this guy says, you farm it out to somebody else to take care of him. So
there's another element of it that was interesting to me too. I got curious one time and looked into the history of the mafia. And everyone thinks of the mafia in a negative connotation, especially think back to gangsters, maybe Al Capone, whatever. Not for no reason, of course. But the foundations of the mafia actually were because they were to protect themselves, their family, La Familia, from the government, because the government was persecuting people. So they all got together and they're just like, no, like, we're going to band together. We're going to protect ourselves. Of course, you start getting into trouble when you have people offering protection and then saying, hey, we're going to extort you, basically, like, hey,
yeah, obviously, protect you, right, if you can. Right, right.
But the whole foundation of it is like a very family centered protect from outside sources thing. So like the Italians, of course, is so deeply embedded. If you like never go against the family, think of movies like The Godfather, whatever. But I even think about like on an American personal level, what a safety net having good family is. Like two parents married, they have a good relationship with their family. You have a good relationship with your family. I even think of like some secular things where you think of the in-laws, like the outlaws or something like that. I just see it as a tremendous advantage if you not only like get along with your in-laws, but also like respect them and they respect you. And so you're able to then
brother
build your circle of influences. You know what I mean? Wait, what do you, what?
I mean, my next door neighbor is my father-in-law. So obviously I believe in this. I mean, I do. I think there's a huge advantage, you know, I do think there's a huge advantage to this. And, you know, I say to my 6 children all the time, like, I love you so much. I'm excited for whatever God has planned for your life, whatever occupation, and whether maybe you'll be religious life or whatever. But I always say this, I would love to live walking distance from you. That's what I love. Have grandma and grandpa, when we get those titles, not yet, obviously, but when we get those titles, to be walking distance, and you can drop us off and you can take care of the kids and then you can go off on a date night. And, you know, there's so many ways in which that's so helpful. Like I've said this before, but like there's one night where I had to run my, you know, I think it was like 3 years old, my little boy into the hospital. And it's like, my wife was working as a nurse that night. Like, how do I leave my other kids? You know, like, but I was able to call my father-in-law and say, hey, you got to come to the house because I'm running to the hospital to get this kid. And, you know, just knowing you have those people you can count on, family, you know, and I have neighbors, my next door neighbors are practically family anyway. So to have that kind of net, social safety net, that's so much better. Like, I know that George W. Bush was so big on this when he was running for president, like in edifying the single mom who works as a waitress. And, you know, it was to show he was compassionate. I mean, I get it. But at the end of the day, that this Italian guy is right. You need to try to emphasize the importance of family. And it used to be the understanding is you would try to get a bunch of acres and you try to, you know, make it so that other family members live near you.
Yeah. Bailey's Park, you get all the houses you build on the land. Yeah, I think maybe that's sometimes my problem with the glorification of the struggling single mom story is that you can almost get to a point where you're glorifying it to the point where it almost seems a little, and then incentivizing it through government means, taxes, etc. When that's not an ideal situation. Like, you could be proud of someone who's going through hard times and making that happen, but I don't think you would sit them down and be like, yeah, no, I actually wish my life was this way. Like, people don't say they have regrets because they're like, well, I learned from everything. But this guy kind of brings that up. Is like, why are we even telling, we're somehow messaging this to people that it would make them happier, that they could accomplish this by themselves. Of course, that's not the truth. And I think we'd be better served with a message to everyone, be like, build your clan, leave your legacy. Like, these are the people that you're going to go to if you're in trouble. These are the people you're going to celebrate with in good times, like celebrating baptisms or celebrating accomplishments. Like, it makes everything richer, and it just also, it makes your life so much better. So maybe, I guess I just,
I think
wish
what
that
the big critique here, more, you know, I think what you're getting at is true. Like, the biggest problem with this guy identified in the video is like a hyper individualism. Like, there's nothing wrong with being, you know, like, everyone has their own, you know, goals, ambitions, life desires, whatnot. That's fine. Like, paint your own picture, whatever. But he's getting at in this video is that it's got to be in the context of like your neighborhood, your family, your clan. And I agree with him 100% on that.
Yeah. It's all good points. We roll into the Twilight Zone now. Just the two of us. Josh, you're up first.
All right. So we were actually at Catholic Vote very proud to have emphasized this prayer campaign that's going on, 9-month prayer novena. You know, you could probably still get started with it. Cardinal Burke is encouraging Catholics to make a 9-month novena to Our Lady Guadalupe. We've mentioned it in the Loop cast before and in the Loop. You know, we're big fans of Cardinal Burke. And he asked us to try to promote this in the Loop. We're not getting anything out of this except for our spiritual warriors joining with us in this prayer, right?
Yeah, you know, except like, the benefit of God above.
Yeah, I'm like, I mean, we ain't getting paid for this. You know, like, Cardinal's there. It's not like we're going to pay much. Yeah, not the point at all. And so, but I feel very blessed that through the work we've done in the Loop, that we were able to help 65,000 people signed up for this. And I'd like to think a lot of those are Loopers. And I'm pretty proud of that fact, actually. You know, like,
I'll allow it.
You know, if I ever get up to St. Peter and he starts going, let's talk about some of the things you did. And I go, oh, boy. Well, hey, you got to put some on the good side of the ledger.
It's on the board. It's on the board. Yeah.
And don't you forget this. You know, I'm trying my best. I went to confession and I got 65,000 Catholics to pray to Our Ladies. Come on, let me in. But so you're thinking, well, what do you mean Twilight Zone? What's the problem here? Okay. So, you know, on the internet, you get these kind of like lefty Catholic cranks. So there's this guy, Mike Lewis, who started this website, Where Peter Is. And this guy is just he's a joke. He said he sees this thing about the 65,000 Catholics joining the prayer campaign. And like, if it irks you, just let it pass, right? Not this guy. Mike Lewis has got to let it be known. He said, so if I had to guess, Francis must have ordered Cardinal Burke to stop publicly trashing the Pope in the Magisterium, but told him public prayers and devotions are okay, which would mean the Catholic right has now added protest novenas to its weaponized liturgy and battle rosaries. Like, What in the world is with this guy? I mean,
this is Beardgate guy.
I'm not
right?
even mad. I'm not even mad. I'm impressed. Like, this is so ridiculous. I'm laughing. I mean, it's like,
that's quite the take. Wow. I've never heard of
Baghdad Bob guys. Like, everything's fine. Things are blowing up behind him. Like, you're so out to lunch, Mike. Get a rest.
Josh, could I get a definition for weaponized liturgy? I'm not sure what he means there. And then battle rosaries.
There are rosaries that are, you know, for prayer warriors. That's what it's meant. Like, the idea is
correct.
You know, the weapon is the rosary. Like, don't get, you know, you see the injustices of the world. Don't grab your guns and start going crazy. Like, pray, you know, and take action through prayer and through social change by voting for the right candidates. But there's nothing wrong with a prayer rosary. And some people get very schemish and skittish about it. I don't understand. Josh, Mike Lewis, definitely one of them.
We didn't talk about Beardgate either. The same guy was saying that bishops were growing out beards in protest of Pope Francis.
I wish that were true. I can't imagine why anyone would do something like that.
Citing that Bishop Strickland grew out a beard and like a few other, he's like going through all of the bishops, like, he has a beard, he doesn't like Pope Francis. Like, what are we doing here, dude? Like, yeah, someone's like, as soon as someone is condemning communal prayer, you know, we should be on their side. Great point, Mitch.
And you know, here's another crazy idea: men grow beards when it's cold, you know,
or when they have testosterone. Imagine that.
Yeah,
something that we
probably
can use.
Not Mike's problem.
We could use more of that in the church. Yeah, I think he's just jealous. He can't grow a beard personally, but that's just a personal take. So I might get in trouble for this.
Give it 10, 15 years too. Maybe you'll be able to grow a beard, Tom.
Hey, watch it. I might grow the mustache back out. So
you do have a good mustache. I'll give you that.
So yeah, mine, I guess, is going to be, I don't know if this is going against what we were just talking about. So I saw this message from Cardinal Dolan, and I know Cardinal Dolan's kind of rubbed me the wrong way after how he handled the St. Patrick's Cathedral situation. This is when the trans activists took it over and were just unbelievably sacrilegious, and then wanted an apology from the church for treating them poorly somehow. Anyway, he was the cardinal kind of in charge of that, handled it poorly, in my opinion. So he comes on, he's been doing these messages over Lent, and I let's just watch it together. And then this is basically just going to be, am I crazy, Twilight Zone? And Josh, maybe you can balance me out here. People listening can balance me out, but go ahead and play it.
Monday, March 11th, folks, Cardinal Timothy Dolan here. Blessings and graces to our Islamic neighbors and brothers and sisters, because their holy season of Ramadan begins today. It's a lot like their version of Lent, which we're going through now as Catholics, as Christians, as our Islamic brothers and sisters take very seriously fasting, acts of sacrifice and self-denial and penance, deeper prayer. Boy, they take that very, very seriously during this month of Ramadan. They're a good example to us as we're on our Lenten journey to kind of be in solidarity with our Islamic brothers and sisters.
So I know you said that, Josh. For maybe my first issue is, like, Ramadan and Lent aren't the same. We might fast, but for very different reasons. And I don't think him saying, like, oh, let's look at those Muslims, they take it very seriously.
That's the part that frustrated me, yeah.
I was like, why wouldn't the inspiration be like, all right, cling more to Christ, let's do Lent harder. He could have set more of an example instead of just,
yeah, let's step up our game, right?
Exactly. And so I don't even have a problem. Actually, very little of my problem is with, like, sending goodwill to the Muslims. Like, I'm all for their culture, for cultural traditions, this and that. But I just think the little, like, the posture of it, be like, oh, let's look at them and get inspired. Like, our fasting's for completely different reasons. We have completely different beliefs about Jesus Christ. And while I'm at it, there's a lot of Islamic slaughter going on in Nigeria of Christians there. So, like, if you really want to get to it, and I want to be serious about my faith, like, I don't think Muslims think very highly of us to the point where they've slaughtered Christians for so many years up until the present day. And so I'm like, why are we spending our time saying that we're somehow right in solidarity with them, and that we should be like, oh, well, they're taking it really seriously, like, you guys should take it more seriously too, in kind of a whiny, patronizing way? it would have been nice to get a really masculine, like, you know, keep the faith. Like, let's take Lent seriously. Like, look at, keep your eyes on the prize. Look for Easter, Christ's resurrection. Muslims don't even believe that. So I was annoyed at all of that. And then I also get the other end, because someone was like, what's wrong with sending them goodwill? I was like, there's nothing really wrong with it. I just think my problem lies more internally, I guess. And I don't even think anything that Dolan didn't, other than the fact that it seems like no cleric is able to say, like, yeah, Islam is a heresy. It's a Christian heresy, which, like, isn't super popular to say.
It's not a Christian heresy. It's just a heresy. They're not.
It's a heresy. Correct. But no one says it. And then they're all like, well, we're trying to do these unifaith, yada, yada, yada. It's like, I just like to focus on our own house first, I guess, was maybe my, which just irked me about it. I don't know.
Well, again, I think it's that we're not trying to totally attack Dolan, obviously, here is the point. And it's just like, if you're going to talk about Ramadan or what, you know, Islam is about, you could use it as a way to, you know, help people better understand, you know, our own faith and say, this should be, you know, like, again, it gets part of my biggest beefs with Western culture right now, Western civilization, is that we're supposed to honor and respect and revere every culture but our own.
Correct.
You know, and that just kind of drives me crazy. And so that this feels like just the latest, you know, additional symptom of that. And it's like, oh, look at these, you know, gosh, you know, the Ramadan, these people, these Islamic people are very serious. They take it very seriously and stuff like that. And I think to myself, yeah, they do. They do. And I imagine if there was an Islamic president who announced how much he loved abortion and supported abortion, that maybe the Islamic leaders of, like, maybe New York City would lambast the president, the Islamic president, for saying something like that.
Exactly.
It does drive me crazy. So maybe, yeah, I mean, why do we have to honor, problem, respect, revere every culture but our own? Like,
right.
Celebrate yourself first. Celebrate your own traditions, your own patronage. That would be my advice.
Yeah, I guess I'm trying to get to the bottom of it, because it feels like a symptom of a larger problem, as you've pointed out. Like, we have a Catholic president, air quotes, talking about, like, the centerpiece of his campaign is restoring Roe v. Wade so that people can kill their children. And there's no central unified pushback from the bishops or the Pope even on this. Like, and if it is, it's not public enough, because I haven't heard it. And if we were a serious church, he'd be excommunicated, because he's publicly advocating against something inherently evil, according to the Catechism of the Catholic Church. So it's like, I don't know if it's a, because of there's so much inaction on that and shame in a lot of this, that they lack the moral clarity themselves to take themselves seriously, because we've just been so inconsistent when it comes to enforcing Catholic teaching, that we look at other places that seemingly are very devout and consistent. And we're like, oh, we almost wish we could have that. But in reality, we were that at one point, not long ago. It feels like a weird modern strain of, like, we need to be ashamed of that. It actually intersects, I think, with being American, as you said, being in the West. Like, America, I think, has a lot of shame over past mistakes as well, or inconsistencies, if you look at how we've interacted in foreign wars, probably since World War II.
So here's what I think it's getting at. Like, you look at Islam, you're like, wow, they pray five times a day. They have a special rug that they use. They face east, and they fast for these days in Ramadan. They have all these different things that they do. And as an outside observer, you're like, oh, that's fascinating. Oh, you take it very seriously. And why do you do this? And why do you do that? Guess what? We don't do enough of that in our own church. That's why I feel like the Eucharistic revival is, sure, it is a good thing. But what if it was the spark that led us to do a back to basics? Because, look, a lot of these bishops that are running our church in this country, I don't mean to say this in a negative way, but you guys all grew up, like, with the Baltimore Catechism or whatever, for the most part, a lot of them. And you knew the basics and you understand the faith. To you, it's like common knowledge. It's like asking me about, like, stuff in politics. Why did the Senate do this and that? Oh, I know why. I could give you an answer like that. Just like every bishop could give you an answer. Well, what's the Catholic Church's teaching on transubstantiation? Oh, well, blah, 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 blah. They could give it to you in a heartbeat, in an instant. But the fact is, so many Catholics don't know it. They don't understand it. You could get them to sing the verses on Eagle's Wings, but they don't know why it is that we believe that, you know, this is actually truly Jesus. It's not just a piece of bread. It's actually Jesus Christ. We don't know those back to basics. So when we see something like Islam, oh, they pray five times a day. Oh, wow, that's interesting. And it's like, you know, actually, they kind of got this from us. You know, we have prayer every day, morning prayer, evening prayer, the Angelus. We have the Liturgy of the Hours. You know, we also used to have it so that our churches would face east. Like, this is not like, you know, rocket science, people, but it's just been forgotten because it hasn't been taught to the new generations. I left the Catholic faith when I was a teenager and I rediscovered it. And the biggest thing I got out of it, the rediscovery, is like, wait a minute. Why wasn't I told any of this? All through the 80s and then early 90s, growing up as a teenager, like, they didn't tell me any of this stuff. It's all about, like, you know, happy clappy stuff and like, oh, yeah. God loves you and wants to give you a hug. Like,
St. Louis Jesuit music. But I'm happy to report, I think we're back. Like, even the fact that people are upset about this is, I think, a good sign, because they're kind of internally recognizing what you're saying. And I'm happy to report, like, I grew up with the Baltimore Catechism, which might blow some people's minds because it basically was erased from churches. But I was raised with a very back to the basics. You know, what do we believe? Part of that was because my parents had like some awesome experiences with different apostolates and a reversion of sorts themselves, which I did too. It was around when I was like 12, 13. But I am like, I received a liberal arts education in the Catholic tradition. And I think the emphasis has been placed on that more when it came with places like Ave Maria. I can't remember the name, Ex Cordiae Ecclesiae, I think, from Pope John Paul II.
Yep, from the heart.
We got a young generation that is on like straight into the veins tradition of Catholicism. And so I think we'll be back. I just think there's that generation.
I love actually your interview about that. Out, but. Remember the interview you did with Steve Minnis over at Benedictine, because he talked about how his school had gone the wayward way back when the Land O'Lakes statement on so-called religious, you know, freedom when it comes to academic freedom in the religious school context. And then they were adrift for decades. And then John Paul II comes out with Ex Cordiae Ecclesiae in 1990 to try to renew Catholic higher education. Benedictine says, let's get on that train. And things turned around for him. And other colleges that from the start, like Christendom, Ave Maria, that said, let's start from day one on the right page. So blessings to all those colleges.
Yeah, I saw something too. I think Nate Hockman did an interview on this. He was talking about just the age disparity between churches that are dying and the churches that are on fire, and how we actually have data now on traditional Latin Mass parishes, how young they are and how vibrant they are, because it's an easy distinction between a church that does the traditional Latin Mass and one that doesn't. I'm not even, again, this, I don't want to get into the trad, not trad thing, but just the fact that something different is going on here and the message here is different than the secular message I'm receiving everywhere else. And churches, Protestant or Catholic, that adopt it, it's similar to the Land O'Lakes thing, where they adopt the secular message and their messaging, especially about Jesus, is not much different than the modern Democrat Party platform. That I'm already getting, so churches that have that messaging, I'm already getting that from everywhere, from media, from institutions, from politics, everywhere. It's no different than what's happening out there. What's happening inside these Catholic traditional back to the basics churches is different than everywhere else you're seeing. The way that it's treated is different. The building itself is different. You look around, you see the beauty. The messages that you're getting are challenging. They're different. So that is what is appealing, because it's authentic and it's different.
Yeah.
And so I think I would like more of that from church leadership now. So I'm seeing it happening at lower levels in churches that I frequent, I guess, or people I talk to.
It's actually funny you said beauty. Get up to the bishop.
Yeah, people come through the door of beauty, no question.
Because Christendom College built that beautiful new chapel, and it's awesome. And then I saw this Twitter thread. This guy talked about churches built in the 21st century here, just in the last 20-some years. And like, and we spotlighted, I think it was the cathedral in Knoxville of the Sacred Heart. Gorgeous, gorgeous. All these new churches that are coming on online. Offline, obviously, actually, in real life, brick and mortar, and they're just beautiful. They're beautiful. We're done with these kind of flying saucer, UFO, 60s, 70s kind of spaceship churches. Give me a break.
Yeah, and I think Bishop Barron was the one who said this, and this came to mind as well. Is like, Some Catholics come through the lens of Catholic converts come through the lens of logic and reason, which probably is a smaller percentage than Catholics that come in through the door of beauty, because beauty is transcendental. Everyone recognizes it. No one can say something that is beautiful is not beautiful. Seriously, everyone knows it speaks to everyone. And so you look at these cathedrals and it elevates your mind to God. That's the whole purpose. That's the total answer to the argument of why doesn't the church just sell away all of its gold and buildings and assets and just give it to the poor? It's because beauty is a gift that everyone gets, rich or poor. Anyway, I could go on and on. I think we got to wrap the show here. we had a lot of people in the chat today. Thank you all for joining us. Again, if you want to join us more often, subscribe, like this episode. We appreciate that a lot. If you want to help us out, reviews, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, we appreciate those as well. I do want to get to doing more mailbag regular content. So if you have questions that you want to answer us to answer, loopcast@catholicvote.org. We'd love to start answering some of these. I need to find some new, I'm going to be coming up with some new opportunities for content in terms of like segments and fun ways to do things. So keep an eye out for that. I'm really thinking about all that right now. And if you want to support the show, loopcast.org, you can help us out. Link will be in the bio. Appreciate all the support. Appreciate you all being here. And Erica sends her best. She's doing great. And we end with St. Thomas More, St. Fidelis, Our Lady of Guadalupe. Pray for us. And we will see you guys on the next episode. Peace.